ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National.
Very suave, erudite kind of guy.
We're here to surprise, delight, and maybe enrage you from time to time. We go where our curiosity leads.
Let's talk crazy. Let's act crazy. Let's be crazy, because then the enemy doesn't know what you're thinking.
Late Night Live, four new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Time for another science show. I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith.
And I know, Belle, that you've been dealing with that cruel bastard, René Descartes.
Yeah, he truly was a heinous human being. But I've only been dealing with him in the interests of caring for animals.
Fair enough. And we're connected in all sorts of surprising ways, even painful ones. And we shall ponder briefly the 50th birthday of the selfish gene a little later. But we begin with this quick trip into and around your brilliant brain with another book, just published with an unlikely title, You're Dangerously Well. It refers to cases of patients whose malady isn't obvious and whose treatment should include tender, loving care, not just industrial meds. And the man behind the book is Professor Roger Rees of Adelaide, famous for treating drastic head knocks. And your title, Professor, Dangerously Well, what does that mean?
What it means is that a patient sees a doctor or someone akin to that who says, my God, you're looking well, but they fail to see what is in fact hidden. So in this case of this woman, Anne Marks, with a severe salivary gland cancer, which was never identified, she was told, look, you're extremely well. I mean, you have low blood pressure, you've never smoked, and you don't have diabetes. My God, you're well. But in fact, she had a life-threatening tumour, which ended when it was excised in her not being able to speak, not being able to swallow, breathing through a trachea, and being peg-fed, and she was given 6 months to live. She, in fact, travelled the world for the next 14 years. But the initial description, from my point of view, and it would have been, because it's an Oliver Sacks term, as you would well know, Robin, she was, in fact, dangerously well.
And when someone looks at you and says, oh, you are looking well these days, and I know that I'm sometimes looking like a bit of a cadaver.
Never, Robin.
A walking corpse. I mean, you prefer the idea that there's nothing wrong with you, because there's nothing more tedious suddenly than having to go through medical procedures. And sometimes you wonder, and you talked about in the launch just now, the robotic nature of some of the medical measures, whether they're just covering their asses, making sure that they're giving the drugs just in case.
It's reinforcing their own status. It's that element to it, because they're not like, well, Sacks. People who spend time with the patient. If we watch a film of Sacks with those people who in the film Awakenings, what does he do? He spends time with them. He becomes them. He becomes congruent with the person he's with.
Now, it just so happens that film Awakenings with Oliver Sacks being portrayed by my namesake.
That's right, yes.
The comedian who's no longer with us, who paradoxically, he was looking well, but he had a neurological problem.
Yes, we're all carrying these neurological problems. I mean, people say to me, oh, my God, you're looking fit. Well, 2 months ago, I had a heart attack, and I'd driven myself to my own surgery, not feeling too well that morning, and the nurse said, I think you should be on your way to the cardiac unit.
You're looking unwell.
Yes, you're looking unwell, you know.
That's a relief, yes.
But it is that. And one of the problems that we have is that our practice in Goolwa is a country, I mean, there's about 8 or 10 doctors there now, and the place is full up with people all the time.
Where is that?
It's a mighty place. It's on the mouth of the Murray. It's where the Murray flows into the Southern Ocean. I went there by chance 25, 30 years ago to set up the outreach program one weekend for the Health Commission for people with severe brain injury. It became the community rehabilitation program for the brain injured and lasted for the next 25 years. in some senses, thanks to you allowing me to talk about it on the Science Show.
Well, in fact, this is the science. There you were looking at the best ways of treating these many young people who were suddenly having set out that morning perfectly fit, and there was a smash either on a sports ground or in a motor vehicle or an assault.
But when we asked the young people who are at high risk, if you remember, that particular project was to identify people who are at high risk, and it was the people who are learning to drive, people in that 18 to 24 age group. And many of the young men, when we made that video, "You're never ever the same again," I said, "Well, what's the principal issue? Is it bad roads?" No, they said, "It's violence." What we mean by violence is that violent behaviour is non-thinking behaviour. It's behaviour which has no contemplation at all, beginning, middle and end. And it occurs because there's a rush of violent fluid to the cortex which makes them fail to think. And their own thinking is like a ponded up river. It's going nowhere. So the only way of outlet for them is to be violent. And you see this all the time.
What's the scientific ingredient? Because this is a science show, of course, not a medical program. You're not talking to Norman Swan.
I think the scientific ingredient is based on my first meeting with the head of mission at the Lifehouse, Chris Milross, and he gave me a copy of The Lancet's compendium paper called The Science of Hope. And there's 80 references in it, and they look at the way in which behaving in a hopeful fashion enables the person not only to proceed in a positive fashion, but that alters the response of their immune system. So that concept of hope, which appears to be something which is social and interpersonal, has in fact a distinct effect on our immune system. And there's a chapter called A Look at Immunity, and the reviewer of it was Peter Doherty, who won the Nobel Prize for his improving our understanding of the immune system. And he's kindly endorsed this book. So we are affecting with hope, but we're affecting the immune system with every piece of behaviour. And Kathy Ellis's book about the new health, she's the professor of biodiversity at Oxford, and she contrasts with Ian McEwan in his statement in his new novel. But she tells a positive view of life based on a much better understanding of our environment and how we nurture the environment. And if we do that, then we're building our own immune system or rebuilding us. Because the immune systems are shot to pieces in societies where the air is so poisonous.
And I think there Professor Rees is referring to social turmoil rather than toxins, where little seems secure and our anxieties then cause our health to suffer. The book is Dangerously Well, Life-Affirming Care at the O'Brien Lifehouse, and all sales of the book go to that hospital in Sydney. Now we leap across to UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, but still with ideas about your brain and well-being. And here I must mention my late cat, a delightful Burmese, who always chose to sleep with us in our own bed, which must frankly have been almost guaranteed an infection with a germ called toxo, a germ I share, it turns out, with a third of the world's population. Meet Dr. Lena Pernas.
I had no idea what I would do. I just knew I wanted to do something with parasites.
And why toxo? Very famous parasite.
Toxo was very serendipitous. I really liked Stanford. At Stanford, there were a couple of parasites that were being researched in different labs, and the lab that I joined was one that worked on Toxoplasma.
It has a reputation, you know, a very famous one, of affecting the brain of the creature that eats it, usually through some other creature's poo, and makes it behave strangely, sometimes being self-sacrificial. Is that just a legend or true, do you think?
Self-sacrificial, maybe taking it a bit too far. I think that's more legend. But what is known is that it rewires the brain of rodents to have them lose their fear of cats. So by losing their aversion to this predator, toxo finds its home and it can end up back in the cat.
What's your research to do with that sort of parasite?
My research journey was also a bit serendipitous. It started when my graduate advisor, John Boothroyd, showed me an electron micrograph of a cell infected with toxoplasma. And one of the most striking features of this micrograph was that all of the mitochondria in the cell, so just like toxo is well known, I think mitochondria are even more well known as the powerhouse of the cell, but all of the mitochondria of that cell were surrounding the parasite vacuole. And so after seeing that image, I was driven by trying to understand, how does this interaction happen? Why do mitochondria end up there? And what does that interaction mean for both the host cell, whose mitochondria are now around the parasite, and the parasite?
Mitochondria, I've got, is it millions of them in all through the body? And
billions, yeah.
And strangely enough, the mitochondria are sometimes thought to have started way back in history as externally living microorganisms that invaded the cell and kept home. So there's a relationship there, isn't there, with adapting to a foreign place?
There very much is. It's helped us think of mitochondria in a different way. So I think what you're alluding to is the theory of endosymbiosis, by which about 1.5 billion years ago, a smaller bacteria ended up in a larger archaeal cell, and over evolutionary time, those became our mitochondria. There's hundreds of thousands of mitochondria in any given cell, and for the longest time, these workhorses, if you will, during infection were considered to be bystanders. But we started thinking of them as the cellular microbiota. So the same way that our microbiota protects us and gives us important nutrients, we started thinking, well, maybe the mitochondria are not just bystanders, but the microbiota of the cell, and they're protecting the cell, because at Afinfina, it's their home as well. And through this, we found that mitochondria are able to compete with invading pathogens like toxoplasma for the nutrients that the pathogens need to grow. And by restricting the pathogen's access to nutrients, they can restrict the growth of the pathogen.
And what have you investigated to apply that story?
We have investigated the nutrient competition, or the competition for two particular nutrients. One are fatty acids and the other are B vitamin folate. And we found that upon sensing toxoplasma, the host cell can rewire mitochondrial metabolism to make these powerhouses of the cell that actually Holly gave me a great analogy for. We think of them now more as the infantry of the cell, to take up more folate or to take up more fatty acids.
So how could that be applied in the health project? Presumably you're looking at human beings and their toxos.
Mm-hmm. Down the line, the hope would be that we can rewire our metabolism by making our mitochondria healthier, by making them take up more fatty acids, for example, which when athletes are doing a certain exercise, they burn more fatty acids. That by finding ways to engineer our mitochondrial metabolism, we can also find ways to restrict the growth of not only toxoplasma, but any other pathogen that needs fatty acids or that needs folates when it infects the host cell.
Do many people actually get toxo in a way that affects their health? I've never quite met one.
I think this raises a very interesting question. So 1/3 of the world's population is estimated to have toxoplasma. However, it's in a form that's thought to be asymptomatic. And what's always been remarkable to me is that this form lives potentially in our brains and is quiet. And so for a long time, the dogma was that chronic toxoplasmosis, so when you've had the infection for more than a year, is silent and asymptomatic and doesn't affect you. But there's more and more studies emerging that indicate that there is a modulation of immune system function in individuals that have chronic toxoplasmosis. So even if you don't have overt symptoms, there are changes in the immune system going on that you are not even aware of. So I think it does affect the immune system component. And then there's been very interesting work from predominantly driven by a Czech scientist, Dr. Jaroslav Flegger, that has investigated how toxoplasma impacts human behavior. And I think he won an Ig Nobel Prize. So these are the prizes that make you laugh and then make you think, for showing that they make men who are infected with chronic toxoplasmosis are more likely to be, I think, indolent and scruffy and take less care of themselves, whereas women are more likely to be intelligent and sexier and risk-taking. So
that doesn't rule out terribly many people. I mean, most men I know are a bit like.
Well, I don't know what the rate is in Australia, but it's usually not a problem for immunocompetent individuals. So for healthy folks, toxo will stay in its chronic stage and it won't cause any overt symptoms. It becomes a problem in two scenarios. One is when an individual becomes immunocompromised. So it became a huge deal during the AIDS epidemic, because all these individuals who had had chronic toxoplasmosis and who were fine started presenting brain lesions and started dying because now this parasite could replicate with impunity. And the other severe problem is for pregnant women. So if a pregnant woman already has toxo, it's not thought to be an issue. But if a woman becomes pregnant, then becomes infected with toxoplasmosis, this can have profound consequences for the fetus. So it can infect the fetus and lead to all sorts of brain deformations and eye problems.
Dr. Lena Panas, who's a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. And by now, I hope you'll see a connection of all those living things like us, a connection so varied and wide that everything from even our genes and our organelles, like those mitochondria, were once outside us, living independently. So let's now briefly, Bell, celebrate the 50th anniversary of those selfish genes.
In the beginning, there was the soup. And the soup, floating like bits of alphabet, were the genes. And the genes were selfish. And so the world was selfish too. I'm Robin Williams, and today the Science Show is all about the whole of natural history, the origins of human beings, and the meaning of life. You may have seen in the shops a glossy book with the fetching title of The Selfish Gene. The cover is surreal, and the style is like science fiction. In fact, it's a serious, and thought by some to be a significant contribution to modern evolutionary theory. Richard Dawkins is the author. He works at Oxford, where one of his colleagues is Desmond Morris, who wrote The Naked Ape. That's a sort of ethological number 96. Actually, Desmond Morris designed the Way Out cover for The Selfish Gene. Now, like The Naked Ape, Richard Dawkins' book gives itself rather a large scope. He tries to explain how altruism could have been produced, that's loving-kindness if you like, by an evolutionary process that seems designed to produce nothing but self-interest. He attacks the way some biologists have talked of populations being the basis for natural selection. And then he jumps right up to human society to say that our culture, our music, our customs and religions could be subject to the same evolutionary forces, selfish ones. And now let's hear what Richard Dawkins himself has to say. After all the popular books we've had in recent years on what's now called sociobiology, why do we need yet another one?
I was stimulated by some of the works that you're probably referring to, for example, Robert Ardrey's Social Contract, which I thought a very interesting book with a very interesting thesis, the only trouble with it being that it was wrong. And I felt it was important that a book so persuasively argued as Ardrey's shouldn't be allowed to go unchallenged. Basically, it's a matter of whether natural selection favours group welfare rather than individual or gene welfare. I wanted to make the point very strongly that it's gene welfare that counts, and that conclusions parallel to those of Ardrey's, but ending up different, could be arrived at if we treat the gene as the unit of selection rather than the group, as he did. I also felt that there are profound questions such as what is the meaning of life, rather pretentious sounding things like that, what is the meaning of life, why are we here, what is man, which could be given a really quite simple and straightforward answer that anybody could understand. And I was intrigued and fascinated by the sorts of answers that modern biology is able to give, and I wanted to share some of that fascination.
You talked about this discrepancy between group and individual. What did Darwin have to say about these things at the time that he actually wrote about them?
Darwin, of course, knew nothing of genes, but that apart, he had it all right, if I can put it like that. Darwin all the time talked about individual welfare, and I think that the only thing one would want to add to what Darwin said is to do with genes. Darwin didn't have the benefit of what we now know about genes, even though, oddly enough, he could have had if he'd read a certain obscure horticultural journal in which Gregor Mendel published his findings on genetics.
Yes, which were not read for, several decades. If we can go back further than Darwin, much, much further, to the time when there were not plants and animals on the world, when there was, if you like, the famous primeval soup with complex molecules floating around in it. Could you tell us how these complex molecules, the basis of life, came to be involved in a process that actually evolved?
The key step in that process was the arising in that primeval soup of molecules which had the power of self-replication. We don't know how that happened. There are lots of theories, lots of speculations about it, but all these speculations seem to agree on one thing, that the key to the process was this matter of replication. It just means that a molecule arose by chance in the primeval soup, which happened to have the property that it served as a kind of mold or template on which copies of itself could be made. And smaller molecules, which were in plentiful supply in the soup, were arranged by this mold or template so that they created an exact copy of the original replicator molecule. Nowadays, the equivalent of that replicator molecule would be called DNA, and it's possible that the original one 4,000 million years ago in the primeval soup was DNA, but it's much more likely that it was some other kind of replicator molecule, and DNA is a kind of later usurper.
So we have the process beginning. How did it become such that many different forms of life evolved? Why make the whole thing so difficult by producing many, many, many different forms of life?
Well, I think first I should say perhaps that the process of replication, first of all, gave rise to what I've called survival machines, which are larger entities not made of replicating molecules, but created by replicating molecules. By that I just mean bodies, you and me, but originally they'd have been much simpler, single cells, perhaps single jackets of protein. These were machines created by the replicators for their own survival, and at the end of 4,000 million years that gave rise to us. Now your question is, why were there so many different sorts of them? Why wasn't there just one form of life that discovered how to do it, so to speak, in the best possible way and then stuck with it?
Yes.
And that is, of course, a very interesting and difficult question. I think I can answer it very roughly. If you start out imagining one single way of life, it might be a simple microscopic plant which floats around in the sea and absorbs sunlight and uses the energy of sunlight to make it the chemicals that it needs. There are plenty of those still left. Why did anything else evolve? Well, the answer is that when you've got a simple form of plant like that, there is the possibility for other organisms to exploit it by eating it. And once you've got the possibility for other organisms to exploit it, then there's the possibility for yet other ones to exploit them. So you have herbivores being exploited by carnivores. Then you have parasites exploiting both herbivores and carnivores. And as each ecological niche is filled, it creates the possibility for yet other ones to be filled in more bizarre and outlandish ways, until now we have thousands and millions of different species all making a living by exploiting each other.
Professor Richard Dawkins in Oxford. And yes, if you suspected that was from a science show nearly 50 years ago, it was. To celebrate the 50th anniversary of Selfish Gene, the book. And Professor Dawkins will be here in Australia in November, I hear. And to carry on with more evidence on how we are so very much connected is Belle Smith. Belle, it's not so much a matter of pain, but also how we also share even feelings with other creatures.
Yeah, that's right, Robin. So a few weeks ago, you might remember we featured an interview with an entomologist who found crickets seemingly feel pain. It's an example of a study into animal sentience. So that's where the various species can feel things like pain, happiness, pleasure, joy, that kind of thing. So you might think, well, why bother with any of this kind of research? Well, short of getting an idea of how flies and cockroaches experience the world, these studies might also change their legal status and maybe one day even give them animal welfare protection.
Even from very early philosophy, like Descartes arguing that animals were just machines that mimic the appearance of experience, but they don't have any inner life.
Dr. Eliza Middleton, an entomologist at the University of Sydney, and yeah, René Descartes being the I think, therefore I am guy, he thought animals did not feel pain and were incapable of experiencing suffering. Any noises an animal might make in response to something that we'd consider painful were, to him, simply the squeaks of a poorly oiled machine.
That concept from the 1600s really shaped Western science and philosophy because they were very intertwined back then. But that, even that machine metaphor, you know, that's been retreating in the face of evidence for 300 years. We no longer look at a dog and think that a dog is a soulless, thoughtless being. We might think it's only thinking about smelling butts and stuff, but it thinks.
And thinking is also relevant to whether an animal feels pain, because pain is more than just that reflex of jerking your hand away from the hot plate when you accidentally touch it. It also involves some level of cognition.
The critical distinction is between nociception, which is our ability to detect a harmful stimulus, which is a reflexive, automatic response that requires no consciousness, and pain, which is that subjective experience of suffering, which requires the brain to generate a negative state. And so with only nociception, we react to touching a hot plate as a reflex. You don't think about it. You have sensed that it's hot and you move your hand. With pain, we learn not to do that again.
So yes, it's generally accepted that vertebrates, like your butt-sniffing dogs, have that level above the reflex response to feel pain. But invertebrates? Well, research into this has really only come about in the past few decades.
Well, I think this really started back in 1991. There's a paper from a group, Zabala and Gomez, and they were looking at whether crickets show any sort of pain-like responses to morphine.
And to do this, these scientists got crickets, gave some of them morphine, and then put them in a box that could get really hot and presumably quite painful. And they found that the crickets that did not get the drugs tried to jump out a lot quicker than the crickets that did have the drugs.
Much like we are able to withstand more pain when we get treated with morphine, they develop tolerance to it, so they need progressively more morphine to deal with a pain. When they're treated with naloxone, which is a chemical that's used to block opioids in humans, it showed the same impact in the crickets, that the morphine was no longer effective when they were treated with naloxone. And it also showed that they get addicted to morphine, much like humans get addicted.
So crickets and humans, we share some similarities when it comes to morphine. And that's interesting, sure. But it's not direct evidence that insects feel pain, just that morphine seems to work on them much like it does on us. But then,
in 2003, which is still a long time ago, researchers at Caltech identified a gene in fruit flies that they named painless because it was essential for thermal nociception. So flies lacking that gene failed to respond to damaging heat. So they were able to, you know, turn that on and off, and there we have some evidence of nociception. So that evidence in invertebrates and insects has been around for, you know, quite a while, I'd say. But the conceptual leap between nociception and experiencing pain, I think, really started to gain momentum in 2019 with Greg Neely's work at UCID with his team. And that was where they showed that the fruit flies can develop chronic pain.
Yeah, fruit flies. And even before 2019, Greg had already discovered the genes in fruit flies that are involved in sensing hot, hot heat. Here's Greg.
And so in that study, we turned off each gene that the fruit fly has one by one, just in their nervous system, in their brain, basically, and their sensory nerves. And then we put them on a test to see if they could detect high temperature that could hurt them.
A bit like the cricket heat test.
And then we basically evaluated animals that could sense the temperature and ones that couldn't sense the temperature.
If the flies still had the genes that could sense heat, well, they tended to jump around or fly to get off the hot surface.
And it basically taught us all the basic machinery that's required for an insect to sense and avoid noxious temperature, so really high, dangerous temperature. And that's similar to our pain sensation.
What is a noxious temperature to a fruit fly?
So anything above 44 degrees Celsius, probably. It depends how long the time is. So if you give them like a 5-minute window, then 44 degrees will knock them unconscious because it's so hot, it hurts them.
So that study looked at acute pain, a sort of one-and-done situation where something hurts, but after a short while, that pain goes away. But the big issue with us humans is chronic pain, which persists well after an injury is healed. And so Greg and his team showed in 2019 that the same could happen in fruit flies.
We basically injured one of their nerves going down their legs, which is basically like sciatica.
They let the injury heal.
And then we watched them under normal situation. They didn't seem to show a lot of spontaneous escape behaviors.
In other words, the flies acted like your typical healthy flies, just, you know, walking around, doing fly things.
So they were acting pretty normal. But then when we put them on a higher temperature, then they would basically run around and jump trying to escape the temperature, even though it's not hot enough really to harm them. So an uninjured animal would just be cool with that temperature. It was 38 degrees. And an injured animal then thought that it was really dangerous.
That response, where flies tried to escape and protect themselves, even in a balmy 38 degrees that otherwise wouldn't hurt them, they acted that way for the rest of their life. Eliza Middleton again.
So that's not a reflex. Reflexes don't generalize across the body. Reflexes don't persist over weeks. That requires some central nervous system involvement.
Okay, so fruit flies seem to have some kind of pain. Crickets too. What about bees?
Bumblebees can make motivational trade-offs around pain. So they're willing to endure a noxious heat for a sufficiently valuable food reward. And that willingness scales with the reward's value. So reflexes also don't make trade-offs. Trade-offs require the brain to evaluate those competing priorities. And that's a signature of experience, not of a mechanism.
There are, of course, arguments against the idea that insects can feel pain. One of the big ones revolves around the size and structure of their brains. They're pretty small and simple compared to ours. So there is the thought that they can't really be conscious because they've got such tiny brains.
But we used to make the same kind of argument about fish, that they couldn't feel because they lacked a neocortex. But fish don't need a neocortex. They have their own neural architecture that does the same job. And I think it's really about what is the question that we're asking. It isn't, do they feel pain the same as us? Because they definitely don't. They don't have the same architecture as we do. But that doesn't mean that that experience is absent.
Okay. If insects experience pain, or their version of it at least, what does that mean for us and them? Back to Greg Neely.
So the very first thing is we share a common ancestor 550 million years ago, insects and humans. Basically, there's an original animal that we both get some of our genes from. And 550 million years ago, pain system had already evolved and been established. And it's very, very ancient. And then second thing is, because we have similar systems, insects can teach us about how our pain works. And then probably the third implication is that, well, if they can experience something like our pain, then are they suffering? And how do we manage that?
And this is where we wade into law and animal welfare and the legal definition of an animal, because not all animals are animals in the eyes of the law. Put very simply, animals, the legal definition of them, are protected by animal welfare law. Animals that aren't legally animals do not have that protection. So in Australia, most states and territories generally define an animal as a live member of a vertebrate species, so amphibians, reptiles, birds, fish, non-human mammals. But invertebrates? Less so. But that's not to say it doesn't happen elsewhere. One of the first places to recognise octopus and other cephalopods as sentient beings was the UK, with the Animal Welfare Sentience Act of 2022. Crabs and lobsters were included under this too. One of the driving forces behind this legislation was philosopher Jonathan Birch at the London School of Economics. He looked into hundreds of studies of cephalopods and crustaceans and found they are sentient. They can have subjective feelings that can be pleasant, like joy, or unpleasant, like pain. Yeah, even prawns. In a report to the UK government, he laid out 8 scientific criteria for sentience. It included things like an animal has the necessary biological hardware to detect noxious stimuli. It might show self-protective behaviours, like tending to a wounded part of the body. It might also learn to avoid noxious stimuli through reinforcement. Now, the report says that there's no single criterion which, on its own, shows that an animal is sentient. But the more criteria an animal meets, the more likely sentience becomes. And insects fulfil quite a few of those 8 criteria.
The Diptera, the flies, and the Blattidae, which are the cockroaches, they satisfy 6 of the 8 criteria of pain. Bees and wasps and also ants satisfy 4.
What about Orthoptera, which includes crickets?
They also satisfy four. So I think it's clear that we're just getting more and more evidence that maybe we were wrong. Maybe they do feel things. Maybe they do have a subjective experience.
So what would it take for insects to be recognised as sentient beings, as octopus and squid were?
Yeah, well, I think this is also a really interesting and worthwhile thing to talk about, because I think it's very clear that the history of animal welfare and animal welfare law is really a history of a line being drawn and then moved and then another boundary and then we move it again. And so with the octopuses and the squids, the research around them to support that decision was less systematic evidence than what we have now for insects. So there was less evidence of them being sentient in terms of meeting strict criteria than what there is for insects now.
Oh, so how did they manage it?
Well, they made it on precautionary grounds, you know, the precautionary principle that if something might be hurt, maybe we just don't hurt it. Like, you don't withhold protections until certainty is achieved. You act when evidence crosses a reasonable threshold.
That said, things are changing in Australia when it comes to invertebrate welfare, but very slowly. So in 2019, the ACT became the first Australian state or territory to change the legal status of animals from property to sentient beings, and that included octopus and crabs. But insects eventually being classed as sentient?
It's tough to say.
Greg Neely again.
There is some kind of philosophical implication to thinking that insects can suffer, but really basically like they have the same kind of senses that we have. They have the same behaviors we have, so they can taste, they can see. It's not shocking that they can detect dangerous stimulus and try to avoid them. I think one thing to note is when an insect is sensing and avoiding noxious temperature, it's not exactly the same as our pain because their brain isn't as advanced as ours, or maybe is advanced in a different way. And so they don't have some of the higher level processing that we have. So we have to be really careful we're not too anthropomorphic and like projecting human experiences onto insects. Their sensing is different than what we sense, but it has a common ancestor.
Even in the absence of changing an insect's status to an animal in the eyes of the law, studies into how they experience the world should change the way we treat them. And this is according to Tom White. His lab did the study which showed that crickets groom a damaged antenna in a way that's similar to a dog licking a hurt paw.
We interact with insects in enormous numbers. The really big ones would be through farming and through pest control and agriculture as well. And so it should encourage us actually to reflect on how we interact with them from their perspective. If they can live better or worse lives, then that creates that responsibility in us, I think, to support them in doing so.
Mm. So use the fly swat, one swift bang to get the fly rather than spraying it and then chasing it around whereas it slowly spins around and dies on the floor.
That's a very acute but straightforward example, yes. I'm not suggesting that we never have to kill an insect again, although, well, no, look, I won't go that far. But if we do and where we do, then we can do better or worse at it. So we can consider it from their perspective as well. Fast is much better in the context of farming. Maybe we move away from methods such as baking them or even blanching or boiling them into something that's faster, more humane, and with some explicit consideration of what might be going on the inside there.
Is that how they're killed?
Yes, there's currently no sort of regulation. So those are common. Freezing in the air, blanching and boiling and convection baking are pretty standard ways of en masse killing insects. And then, of course, out in the wild, lots of different pest control methods like insecticides, pesticides. But those are all developed only with efficacy. So do they kill or not in mind? Of course, there's no question of how they kill. And some may be fast, some may be slow. So yeah, it may prompt a bit of a rethink as how we go about these things.
Dr. Tom White from the University of Sydney. Does this change how you treat mosquitoes in the house, Robin?
Well, my body has an automatic reaction now that I'm 104. And Descartes, I was at school with him, of course, always told me that you can't be to blame for what your hand does automatically.
It's a reflex, sure.
That's right. Yeah, boom. Oh, sorry. This is The Science Show on ABC Radio National. And so, having been relatively quiet about the greenery today, plants that is, they too are showing explosive numbers if you look about how many more species are being found all the time here in Australia. Do join me now in northern Queensland with Professor Darren Crane and a really special herbarium.
How long has this herbarium been up and running?
In this location since 2008, but we operate as a joint venture. The three partners in the joint venture are the Queensland Government through the Queensland Herbarium in Brisbane, the CSIRO through the National Herbarium in Canberra, and JCU. And so we formed this joint venture in 2008 and brought together three small collections that existed in North Queensland here but weren't strongly connected. So we brought them together into a new purpose-built facility, brought all the staff of those institutions together.
Now you have critical mass.
Now we have critical mass, absolutely. And things are off and humming, and we're doing things collectively that none of us could have done individually.
I cannot resist the obvious question. How many specimens do you have here?
Close to 200,000. To the integer, exactly how many we have, because they're all databased. So you can see that each of these specimens in these pigeonholes in this compactus unit comprises a twig, usually, pressed and dried and stored between archival paper and stacked up with other specimens of those species. And collectively across the whole collection, we've got nearly 200,000. All of the metadata associated with each of those scientific specimens is databased. And it's all available publicly through a wonderful portal called the Atlas of Living Australia.
Excellent. And you have selected three examples here for me. And the first one, Ex Queensland Herbarium Erythro. Erythro, that reminds me of blood.
Yes. Erythroxylum ellipticum. Erythro meaning blood, oxalum meaning wood.
Bloodwood.
It's not a bloodwood. You might assume that from the name. But I got this one out because some will know that Erythroxylum is the genus of plants that produces cocaine. Now, it's a genus of plants that's found worldwide, and one species found in South America is the source of cocaine. We have probably five, maybe more species in Australia. Some of them are yet to be given scientific names, of the same genus. And we don't think the Australian ones contain the same alkaloids that are highly prized in some quarters. But nonetheless, I got this out because it helps us tell the story of the broader value of conservation. We talk about conservation of our biological diversity as a means to retain our natural heritage, but we can also talk about conservation as a means to preserve our capability to support industries of the future.
Industries? Not cocaine industries.
Not necessarily cocaine, but there could be very useful medicinal compounds in here that could be, you know, the next treatment for some horrible disease.
And of course, you have an association with indigenous knowledge about which were the medical plants, leaves, that were exploited, and so you know where to look.
Absolutely. And we are working with a number of indigenous groups hand in hand in partnership arrangements that are equitable, at their invitation, in order to characterise their medicinal plants, try and work out what the compounds are that are responsible for that medicinal effect, and potentially produce patentable products that can deliver economic benefits back to those communities at some point in the future.
And what's the next one we've got to look at?
The next one is another example of a native Australian plant that has recently been investigated, again in partnership with the traditional owners, for its medicinal properties. So this one is interesting because it was actually only named a bit more than, I think, 15 to 20 years ago now. So it's a species that's been relatively recently characterised by science. It's used medicinally by the indigenous people of the southwestern Atherton Tablelands here as a topical treatment for skin diseases. And so we're working with some biochemists and natural product scientists in the Australian Institute of Tropical Health and Medicine to see if we can identify what compounds in those plants are responsible for that medicinal effect. Mm. And if they're novel compounds, then the potential remains there for patenting and for economic benefits.
I'm going to ask a ridiculous question. It reminds me of leguminosae, in other words.
That's exactly what it is. It's a legume.
No.
It's a legume, yes.
A legume, yeah.
Absolutely.
And you've got something that's almost like an open pea pod.
That's right, yeah. The legumes are, of course, the pea and the bean family, as you so cleverly just stated. They're interesting, a huge family of plants globally. They're very ecologically important, agriculturally important, of course.
Absorbing nitrogen.
Because it's the microorganisms that take up residence in the root nodules of a leguminosus plant, which are doing the nitrogen fixation, that are drawing nitrogen from the atmosphere and converting it into useful nitrogen, which then enhances the soil. So it's not so much the plant itself, it's the plant acting as a host, if you like, for the microorganisms that are actually doing the nitrogen production. So you often find plants of this family in soils that are low in nitrogen because they have this ability to create their own.
And finally, there's a broad... Is it correct to call it a broadleaf? Because it's got bigger leaves.
Bigger leaves. This is a rainforest vine. This one was literally named scientifically about a week ago.
No!
By one of our scientists here, Dr. Wendy Cooper. And we've known about the plant for some time, but it was always thought to be part of a broader, more widespread species. But when she got in and did the detailed taxonomic work, including some genetic analysis, she realised that this plant is actually quite distinct from more broadly ranging species. It's a climber. It grows in the rainforest. It's got some hideous thorns growing on the stems here that you can see that it uses to climb up into the canopy. And it's a close relative of capers. In fact, it's in the genus that capers are in. So the capers you eat, you grind up to make sauces and things like that, and you throw in your stir fries. It's an Australian caper berry. But it has a really big, glorious flower. And because of that, the name that Wendy gave to it was Caparis, Caparis being the genus name, and the species name is Splendidissima. Exceptionally splendid.
Yeah.
Because of the great big flower that it has. It's quite a stunning thing. Mm. This is an example, I guess, of the fact that sort of the classification and the naming and the scientific description of life is an ongoing process that, you know, we've barely just begun for some groups. We've been at this, at least on this continent, for 255 years now, but we're still discovering, or scientifically discovering, of course, Indigenous people have known about these plants for millennia and have their own names for them and their own classification systems. But within the Western scientific system, we're still naming plants at an extraordinary rate and a globally exceptional rate. So on this continent, botanists are naming on the order of 150 new plant species, and this is plant species alone, every year.
That's most impressive. And of course, if you look out the window at this huge landscape in northern Queensland, the treasures could be unbounded.
Absolutely. But it's not just the rainforest. The rainforests are incredibly biologically rich, of course, but it's often drier, less attractive country that hasn't attracted the attention of the botanists in the past that yields the most discoveries. And particularly in Western Australia, where some parts of that state have been under mining leases for decades in some cases, and the mining leases get activated and the botanists get in there to do environmental assessments and turn up new plant species all over the place because nobody's been there. Nobody with the right knowledge has been there at the right time.
I wonder how many Australians know the extent of what's going on.
Probably not many, but it's something that we're quite proud of. As I say, 150 new plant species on average, year on year. And globally, that is only exceeded by two other countries, one of which is Brazil, no surprises there. The other is China.
Aha.
Mm.
And you're working in cooperation to some extent with some of your scientists with Chinese.
Not only Chinese, but we in the herbarium community have long collaborated globally. We've got long-standing standards, if you like, for exchanging and donating our collections to other like-minded institutions around the world and them donating specimens they collect to ours. So in our little collection here in remote North Queensland, we've got specimens from all over the world. We had a Swedish scientist come here recently because he was interested in the botanists who travelled with Cook. Sir Joseph Banks was one, but the other lesser-known botanist was a Swede called Daniel Solander. And so we had a researcher come out from Sweden to retrace Solander's steps, if you like, or paddles.
Paddling, yes.
And he came into the herbarium here and he just said, oh, I don't suppose you have any Swedish plants here. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, we do. It was only about a 7 or 8, but I said, we have some. And I got them out and he was mightily impressed.
Professor Darren Crane, director of the Australian Tropical Herbarium, and I was shocked to find out that there's about 150 new plant species discovered every year from Australia. So that's second highest rate in the world, second only to Brazil. And the Tropical Herbarium is really, truly, like you said, a very special place, an absolute treasure. Also a treasure for astrophotographers have been the Ripper Auroras we've been seeing over the past couple of years. There are a few months there where I couldn't open social media without seeing loads of stunning photos of red and green and violet lights all over the place. But are auroras an Earth-only phenomenon? In this instalment of Weather Off Earth, we're looking at space weather. That's what causes those auroras we see, and find out if other planets get these lights in the sky too. Here's Dr. Chelsea Huang, an astronomer at the University of Southern Queensland.
Auroras happen when a solar storm happens. This is when the sun releases a stream of very high-speed electrified gas to outer space. And these gas are usually composed by electrons and protons. And when this solar storm passes through Earth, some of the particles will get trapped by Earth's magnetic field. And they will stream down along the magnetic field to the poles of Earth. And these high-energy particles will hit Earth's atmosphere, excite the molecules in our atmosphere, and then cause them to emit light. That's actually why you typically see auroras with different colors. Green is actually mostly from oxygen, and sometimes oxygen also emits a little bit of red-orange light. And then you would have blue and purple from nitrogen.
Right, okay. So the ingredients for an aurora are charged particles from a star, like a solar storm, and a planet with an atmosphere and a magnetic field. Is that right?
Yes. So if you have any of these conditions, we expect the planet to have auroras.
And so what sort of planets do have these conditions?
The Hubble Space Telescope have imaged auroras on both Jupiter and Saturn. The one on Jupiter's atmosphere is extremely interesting because on Earth, we typically expect the strength of auroras corresponding to the strength of solar wind. Except on Jupiter, it also correlates with the orbital period of one of Jupiter's largest moon, Io.
Huh.
So this is very interesting because we believe Io has molten lavas underneath it, and Io interacts with Jupiter's magnetic field and caused some interesting connections between Io and Jupiter. And these particular connected magnetic field interact with the solar wind and then amplify the auroras when the Io orbiting around Jupiter.
Wow, okay, so the iron in Io, I guess it tinkers maybe with Jupiter's magnetic field. And so what does that do to the auroras? It just makes them more spectacular?
It makes it sometimes become stronger and sometimes becomes weaker while Io orbiting around Jupiter. We actually see this more obviously in the radio emissions from Jupiter because when solar storm hits Earth, we not only just see the optical lights, which is aurora, but we also have radio signals from the solar storm interact with the magnetic field.
Of course, like I've never thought about this really, but it does make sense that the light that's produced when solar storms interact with magnetic fields isn't just optical light, the light that we can see, but also other wavelengths, like the longer wavelengths, radio waves. And we have telescopes on Earth that can detect those radio waves from Jupiter when it gets auroras too. And what about Saturn?
Yeah, so Saturn also has auroras observed by the Hubble Space Telescope, but I don't believe any of Saturn's moons interacting with it in such an interesting way.
Do we see auroras on planets outside of the solar system?
And currently, we actually don't have the capability of observe auroras around planets around other stars yet, but we're actually hoping to be able to observe them soon. Many planets orbit very close to their host star, so we expect the planet's magnetic field will interact with their host star's magnetic field, similar to how Io interact with Jupiter's magnetic field. And when their host star's solar wind pass through this interaction, we expect to observe radio moderations corresponding to the orbital period of the planets. And this radio signal currently is not reachable with this generation of radio telescope. But as you know, Australia is building the Square Kilometer Array that will be a lot better at observing radio signals in the outer space. And we're hoping to use the SKA to detect this kind of signal in the next decade.
Okay, so while we might not be able to actually see the lights, we'll be able to pick up the radio signature of an aurora when it happens on an exoplanet, hopefully.
Yes, that's the hope.
Dr. Chelsea Huang, an astronomer at the University of Southern Queensland.
And I hope Lisa Gershwin in Hobart was listening, our glow queen.
Production by David Fisher. I'm Belinda Smith.
And I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.